Back to the Bible, J. Sutcliffe, 1933. Much of the scepticism regarding the Bible arises from undue deference to current and intellectual fashions, and the absence of downright thought about its claims. Few men have read the book, which they ignore or treat with silent contempt. Its authority is flouted by men in order that they may meekly accept the yoke of modern thought. They think that what is new is up to date, and must therefore be true and more worthy of belief than what is old. Such an attitude condemns itself, for what is new today will be old tomorrow, and therefore antiquated and unworthy of belief. The only sane attitude is to test all things and hold fast that which is good. Loosed from the ancient authority of the Bible, men drift from one opinion to another. Each man appears to feel quite justified in making a private religion for himself. In a sea of doubt and confusion, one man's opinion is considered as good as another's, and that belief is adopted which pleases and soothes. We are told that the dead are alive and actively concerned in our welfare, and for a monetary consideration, a kindly medium will put us into communication with them. Others tell us that ultimately all will be saved. And then arises a gloomy voice which informs us, in the name of science, that man sinks to the level of a placental mammal, with no more importance for the universe at large than the fly of a summer's day, which dances its brief hour in the sunshine before it descends forever into endless night. All these conflicting theories are founded upon the opinions of men who, in many cases, have formed them without adequate and conscientious inquiry into the basis of their opinions. Is there no guide amidst this confusion? Can we find no deliverance from the constantly changing opinions and speculations of men? We believe that the Bible is such a guide, that it is a lamp to the feet and a light to the path, and we ask you to come back to a careful and studious consideration of its teaching. But first, let us examine some of the obstacles which the ideas fashionable today may have placed in your way. There is undoubtedly a modern prejudice in favour of the natural, which causes men, especially students of nature, to leave God out of account. They appear anxious to discover the laws of nature by ignoring the God of nature, and it is no wonder that some end by denying his existence. This prejudice has been instrumental in raising a false antithesis. Faith in God has been set in opposition to reason. Belief in a divine revelation has been accounted credulity, which reason helps us to overcome. Perhaps there is no real justification for setting revelation and reason in opposition at all. What I think is amazing is how little the modern intellectual world, which claims to be and appears to be seeking God with all seriousness, how little it faces the question of the reality of positive divine self-revelation. That was a quote from Gore on the reconstruction of belief. If we believe that God exists, we cannot deny that he may have chosen to reveal himself and his purpose in such a way that man can know him and obey him. If this revelation is a fact, then obviously it is the most important fact that man has to face. When we find that the Bible claims to be such a revelation, surely the very least we can do is to give it our own most careful consideration and study. Let us beware at the outset of deciding in our own minds what such a revelation ought to be, if it is to suit us, and then proceeding to sit in judgment on the Bible. One of the chief obstacles to the acceptance of the Bible's claim to be the production of holy men of God who spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit, which is its claim, is the work of the higher critics. Although the man in the street is not familiar with their writings, he has a vague idea that they have demonstrated that the Bible has no real authority or authenticity, and the effect on his mind is that he feels he can ignore it quite safely. Their analysis of the Pentateuch into countless fragments, supposedly put together by unknown editors, has destroyed the average man's faith in Moses and the patriarchs. Canon Chain said, "I am myself one of those who hold the historical existence of a personage called Moses to be unproved and improbable." Such a statement leaves one breathless with astonishment when the extent to which Moses is connected with the history of Israel in the Old Testament is pondered. Though it claims to be a science, the higher criticism is actually only pseudo-scientific. Its findings are vitiated by its presuppositions that miracles do not happen. Hence, the whole Bible is reduced to the level of merely human writings and is in no sense a divine revelation, and that the whole course of Israel's history slowly evolved from primitive barbarism and polytheism to a high degree of civilization and monotheism under purely natural influences. Speaking for higher critics as a body, Kuenen, K-U-E-N-E-N, writes, "For us, the Israelitish is one of those religions, nothing less but also nothing more. There is no specific difference between Israel's religion and its sisters. Without a shadow of doubt, we deny the existence of such a difference." The religions he refers to are Hinduism, Buddhism, Mohammedanism, and the rest. And these words echo the words of Gibbon that in the Roman Empire, all religions were considered by the philosopher equally false. It is not surprising that the critic who begins his researches with these theories, after dismembering the Bible in the interests of his presuppositions, concludes by presenting us with a complete reconstruction of the familiar history which we entirely fail to recognize. The higher critical method is intensely subjective. It is a typical product of the German professional mind in its dependence upon the critic's own predilections and its minute, laborious research into words uncontrolled by reference to historical reality. It delights in laying down impossibilities. And here is a typical extract from Wellhausen on Genesis 14. He says that at the time of Abraham, four kings from the Persian Gulf made a razia or raid as far as the peninsula of Sinai. That's they on that occasion surprised and captured five city princes who reigned in the Dead Sea. That finally Abraham at the head of 318 servants fell upon the departing visitors and recaptured what they had robbed. Oh, these are simply impossibilities. This was written in 1899. Here is one of the commonest occurrences of all history. A raid and a military surprise of the victors flushed with success. On what grounds does Wellhausen say it is impossible? Such raids are commonplaces of ancient history and well within the bounds of historical probability. Wellhausen might have said that the raid did not take place, but that would have required proof, which he could not supply. Instead, he delivers himself of an utterance ex cathedra, speaking from his professor's chair to his admiring students. The professor has spoken. It must be so. This hopelessly absurd and arbitrary statement proceeds from the requirements of the critics of presuppositions. Professor Sayce says that the historical character of Chedorlaomer's campaign has been amply vindicated by the inscriptions, and although S.R. Driver does not agree, he reluctantly admits that the campaign may, in outline, be historical. How then can it be the impossibility that Wellhausen calls it? The higher criticism is out of touch with reality. It is the work of scholars familiar with books and armchair theorizing, but not with ancient lands and civilizations. They play tricks with words, which they call conjectural emendation. This merely means altering words of the text at a guess in order to lend countenance to their own ideas. When no suggestion is offered by any ancient versions or manuscripts, the scholar will deliberately change the consonants of a Hebrew word and suggest possibly a letter has slipped out or slipped in, or this letter should be changed to that, and so on, and he murmurs a hint of corruption or interpolation when he does not understand the meaning and alters or omits at his own will. If any voice is raised in protest, it is overwhelmed by the imposing array of scholarship marshalled against it. Dr. Schweitzer is famous for his solution to the problems of the life of Jesus by the consistent application of the principle that Jesus expected the catastrophic establishment of a kingdom of God upon earth. And the following words of his throw light upon higher critical methods. This is what he says: because this solution is such as to make comprehensible so much in the thought, the discourses and the actions of Jesus which has been incomprehensible hitherto, it establishes the genuineness of a number of passages which, because unintelligible, were held to be unhistorical. In this way, the eschatological interpretation of the life of Jesus puts an end to all need to doubt the credibility of the Gospels of Mark and Matthew. Here we have the amazing admissions that passages in the Gospels which the critics did not understand were for that reason considered unhistorical, and that when we really understand the Gospels, there's no need to doubt them. The ignorance of critics then is to determine what is historical in the Bible or not. We are reminded of the undergraduate's doggerel. I am the head of Balliol College, and what I don't know isn't knowledge. Could learned arrogance go further? Here is another example from Dr. A.B. Bruce, who comments on Luke chapter 2. One could almost wish that verse 2 had been omitted, or that there were reason to believe, as has been suggested by several writers, that it is a gloss that has found its way into the text, and that Luke is not responsible for it. So much trouble has it given to commentators. No wonder that Sir W.M. Ramsay remarks on this by saying, "These words crystallize in a gem of criticism the inadequate method and the falseness of view, which could result in the thought that the convenience of the commentator should be put as a test of truth." Note also this mention of the suggestion that the words are a gloss, that is, an unauthorized and unauthentic addition to the words of the Gospel by some unknown person. This is a common refuge for the commentator whenever a difficulty arises. Sir W.M. Ramsay began his travels in Asia Minor with the usual prepossessions and opinions derived from the critics Robertson Smith, Bauer, and Wellhausen. In his book on the bearing of recent discovery on the trustworthiness of the New Testament, he writes as follows: "The following chapters will show how the discovery of new evidence, partly by others, partly by myself, changed the judgment and formed opinions of one who had aimed at truth and lived for truth." He says that he accepted the current opinion that the Acts of the Apostles was written during the second half of the second century by an author who wished to influence the minds of people in his own time by a highly wrought and imaginative description of the early church. Such was the commonly accepted view in the critical school about 1870 to 1880, when I had been studying modern opinions. It is now utterly antiquated. There is not one point in it that is accepted. Everything is changed or discarded. But about 1880 or 1890, the book of Acts was regarded as the weakest part of the New Testament. No one that had any regard for his reputation as a scholar cared to say a word in its defense. The change is due in no small measure to Ramsay's own painstaking travels and excavations in Asia Minor. He now says that he takes the view that Luke's history is unsurpassed. past in respect of its trustworthiness. And his testimony is doubly valuable because he began with higher critical beliefs and abandoned them when in contact with reality. His studies, he says, showed that the book could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority for the facts of the Aegean world, and that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement. It is marvellously concise and yet marvellously lucid. He refers to Blass's commentary on Acts, and he says, "It is written by a Greek scholar of the old type who studied literature and paid the minimum regard to the circumstances and facts of social life, except so far as these express themselves in words. For grammar and sense, his commentary is most suggestive and valuable, but for society and history, it is misleading." This typical example shows how the men of words are confuted by the men of action. The critics in the armchair are proved wrong by the evidence which the archaeologist finds in the field. Ramsay says, "The evidence to test all important history, and especially the Old and New Testaments, exists and can be discovered with patience, knowledge, ingenuity, and money." The present position with regard to the Acts of the Apostles is well summed up by Mr. Rackham. He says, "The ground covered by St. Luke reached from Jerusalem to Rome, taking in Syria, Asia Minor, Greece, and Italy. In that field were comprised all manner of populations, civilizations, administrations, Jewish and Oriental life, Western civilization, great capitals like Ephesus and Antioch, Roman colonies, independent towns, Greek cities, so-called barbarous country districts. The history covers a period of 30 years, which witnessed in many parts great political changes. Provinces like Cyprus and Antioch were being exchanged between the emperor and the senate. Parts of Asia Minor, for example Pisidia and Lycaonia, were undergoing a process of annexation and Latinization. Judea itself was now a Roman province under a procurator, now an independent state under an Herodian king. Yet, in all this intricacy of political arrangement, St. Luke is never found tripping. St. Luke is equally at home with the Sanhedrin and its parties, the priests and temple guards, the Herodian princes at Jerusalem, with the proconsul of Cyprus and Achaia, the rulers of the synagogue and first men of Antioch to Pisidia, the priest of Zeus at Lystra, the praetors, lictors, and jailer of Philippi, the politarchs of Thessalonica, the Areopagus of Athens, the Asiarchs with the people, assembly and secretary of Ephesus, the centurions, tribune and procurator of Judea, the first man of Malta, and the captain of the camp at Rome." Such accuracy would have been almost impossible for a writer compiling the history 50 years later. In some cases where his statements had been impugned, St. Luke has been signally vindicated by the discovery of inscriptions, as in the case of the Polytarch of Thessalonica and the proconsul of Cyprus. At last, the critics have begun to notice, then, that the results obtained by archaeologists and are betraying uneasiness about their conclusions. The excavators who are in direct contact with the remains of buried civilizations are, almost to a man, believers in the historicity of the Bible. Let us take another lesson in contrasting higher critical conclusions with the archaeological results. In Peake's Commentary on the Bible, there is a section on Joshua by the Reverend Samuel Holmes. After suggesting a reconstruction of the history, he says, "If this reconstruction of the history of the conquest is approximately true, the narratives of our book are simply an unscientific endeavour to account for certain historical facts known to the writers. The events recorded in chapters 1 to 12 can, according to most scholars, be taken as having some historical basis, and the last 12 chapters of the book are generally admitted to have little, if any, historical value." He concludes, "According to critical investigation, the book appears to be a medley of contradictory narratives, most of which are unhistorical." Well, the extracts reveal the authentic note of higher critical teachings. The use of the word unscientific and the phrases "according to most scholars" and "generally admitted" is intended to overawe the simple and unlearned. How dare any man doubt what most scholars say can be? The answer to all this higher critical dogmatizing is to be found in Professor John Garstang's Joshua Judges. During the 7 years that he directed the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem and the Department of Antiquities in Palestine, he visited repeatedly all the historic sites undergoing excavation. He was deeply impressed with a sense of material reality underlying the historical narrative, his words, of Joshua and Judges. And he says, "Three selected cities, Jericho, Ai, and Hazor, were examined more thoroughly with the spade, and the impression now became positive. No radical flaw was found at all in the topography and archaeology of these documents." He also eliminated, he said, "the difficulties of chronology, which have long perplexed students." And as a result, he says, "after years of study, it has convinced the writer that not only were these records in general founded upon fact, but they must have been derived from earlier writings almost contemporary with the events described. So detailed and reliable is their information." Now compare this with Holmes' statement: "Most of these later chapters come from the priestly writer and were written after the exile, that is more than 800 years later than Joshua." Need we lay stress upon the contradiction which exists between the conclusions of the critic and those of the archaeologist? The discoveries at Jericho made by Professor Garstang are now commonplaces. Suffice it to say that he discovered that the city was destroyed by fire, as recorded in Joshua, and that the walls, he says, fell outwards so completely that the attackers would be able to clamber up and over their ruins into the city. Now, this entirely disposes of Peake's note in his commentary that the recent excavations at Jericho do not support the historicity of the statement that the walls collapsed. And he refers to Hancock's Archaeology of the Holy Land, written before 1919. Time, as usual, has proved the critics wrong, not merely as to fact, but has demonstrated the futility of their methods. What value can we attach to conclusions and arguments that the discovery of monumental evidence has proved absolutely wrong? Surely none. The edifices which the critics build with such pains will fall like houses of cards when the wind of reality blows upon them. Another excavator who has a little of the higher critic about him is Mr. Leonard Woolley. His discoveries at Ur of the Chaldees have revolutionized our ideas of Abraham and his times. In Hastings' single-volume Dictionary of the Bible, Skinner writes, "The history of Abraham consists of a number of legendary narratives which have been somewhat loosely strung together into a semblance of biographical continuity." And the brief article on Ur in the same work tells us that the identification, that is, of the mound of Mukaiyah with Ur, has not been universally accepted. Well, again, time has shown the errors of the critics. The mound has been opened, and it certainly contains the remains of Abraham's city of Ur. We know more about Abraham's city and era than we do about Alfred the Great. He is no creature of legend or myth, but a real personality moving about in scenes which the work of the archaeologist enables us to picture vividly and accurately. While the work of the critic tends to dissolve biblical history into myth and legend, loosely strung together, the work of the excavator reveals in clearer and deeper outline the truth of the inspired history. The book of Daniel has long borne the brunt of higher critical attacks. Dr. S.R. Driver favoured the conclusion that it was not written before 300 BC. He says, among the confused and inaccurate traditions, such as might easily be current in an age later than that of Daniel himself, he mentions that Belshazzar was not styled king by his contemporaries. Once more, the Bible has been proved correct by facts, and the theories of the critics refuted. Documents in cuneiform prove that Belshazzar, the son of Nabonidus, exercised at Babylon such administrative powers as belonged to no mere crown prince. Indeed, it is expressly stated that in the third year of Nabonidus, the king entrusted the kingship to his eldest son, Belshazzar. According to Sidney Smith in his Babylonian Historical Texts, 1924. This would seem to explain the dignity of the third ruler in the kingdom conferred upon Daniel. This is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. The same authority further adds that the picture of Belshazzar in chapter 5 has quite generally been pronounced unhistorical by modern scholars. But recent discoveries have tended to show that the historical background of the chapter is substantially correct. So much for driver. If driver considered that inaccuracy was a proof that Daniel was written in a later age, then we may reasonably consider that the accuracy which time has revealed is proof of the fact that Daniel was written in the contemporary age. The evidence for the accuracy of the book of Daniel will be found in the book in and around the book of Daniel by C. Boutflower, who pertinently asks, are we not then justified in regarding the book of Daniel as genuine history rather than as a religious romance, the work of a later age? The work of the archaeologists still continues, and it is now a popular feature of certain journals to retell the discoveries for the interest of their readers, and in this way it has become a matter of common knowledge that the flood and the Tower of Babel were historical and not mythical. The Old Testament has been rescued from the region of unreality and legend into which the critics have vainly endeavoured to drive it, and we can now read its histories with confidence. Before we leave the critics, there's a very grave matter to be dealt with. Many of their conclusions are opposed by the authority of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Canon Chain did not believe in the existence of Moses. Jesus said to the Jews, think not that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuseth you, even Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if ye believe Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. And if you believe not his writings, how shall he believe my words? And in a discussion with the Pharisees on Psalm 90, Jesus asks, how then doth David in the Spirit call him Lord? Professor Kirkpatrick says, the question assumes that the psalm was written by David and that it was inspired. No, Professor Kirkpatrick. The question affirms it by using the word saying. The critics say that David did not write the psalm and that it has no messianic reference. It is obvious that this conclusion is in flat contradiction to the words of the Lord Jesus and to the belief of the Jews, his contemporaries. Let the issue be quite clear. If Christ is right, the critics are wrong. And we must decide whose authority shall have our allegiance. The Old Testament we have in our hands today is a translation of the Hebrew scrolls which were in use in the time of Christ. That Old Testament received Christ's approval and was his never-failing sword of the Spirit. Have ye never read? He would ask. To the Sadducees he said in rebuke, ye do err, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. On the way to Emmaus, beginning from Moses and from all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. That's Luke 24. The Old Testament canon was complete, and substantially that which we use today, irrespective of any arbitrary assignment of sources or subjective reconstruction by higher critics from imaginary documents which no man has yet seen. The book which Christ loved and studied and used will not fail us if we handle it under his guidance and according to his methods. Another obstacle which lies in the way of some who would fain come back to the Bible is the notion that the Bible contradicts science. Let's be clear exactly what we mean. Do the sciences of chemistry, physics, biology, geology, and astronomy. They supply us with facts which are not in harmony with biblical statements. A moment's reflection will tell us that the answer is in the negative. The conflict is between the theories of men and the Bible. We must remember that the theories of science are the most changeable portions of it. They are attempts to explain and correlate facts. They are only useful so long as they do this adequately. The discovery of fresh facts often causes a theory to be discarded as being inadequate and inaccurate. And the history of scientific explanation is a history of continual correction of erroneous theories. Let us not be discouraged if the Bible is not in agreement with the latest scientific theories. The Bible will still be with us and as vital as ever it was when present-day theories have been discarded for those which are still hidden in the bosom of the future. The plain fact, of course, is that the Bible is not a scientific book and does not claim to be so. It does not teach any of the sciences we have referred to, and it is only in passing that it refers to the facts which form the subject of those sciences. Science is practically the production of the last 100 years. The Bible was written in a pre-scientific age. But this is no detriment, since this is not the purpose of the Bible to teach science, but to reveal God. The Bible is lacking in nearly all that is typical of modern science. The scientific nomenclature, which is so important in the sciences of chemistry, botany, and zoology, is entirely absent. The language used may be termed popular. That is suited to the ordinary man and according to the appearance of things. It is absurd to object that the Bible is wrong in referring to the rising and setting of the sun, although we do likewise, and the like. Such statements, when they occur in the Bible, are not intended to be precise scientific statements of phenomena, but popular descriptions which the ordinary man can understand because they tally with his experience. If the Bible had been written in the language of modern science, it would have been unintelligible for the last 2,000 years or more, and it would now soon be rendered obsolete by the scientific discoveries yet to be. Most of the references in the Bible which come within the field of science are to be found in the poetical books such as the Psalms, Job, and the Song of Solomon, or in the poetical portions of the prophets. For example, the sun is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race, Psalm 19. Where wert thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Is the question God puts to Job. Are these statements to be reduced to prosaic terms? Can we not discern their poetic beauty and the truth they convey? A literal interpretation of some passages would make the Almighty a bricklayer or a stonemason. In fact, some have not scorned to refer to the carpenter theory of creation because, forsooth, God made the universe and formed man. Now, there's one principle of biblical interpretation which will guide us securely in dealing with this question of science. The biblical writers account for the existence and production of phenomena not by attempting to explain them, but by attributing them to God. Psalm 104. He causeth the grass to grow for the cattle, and herb for the service of man. And Job 37. God thundereth marvellously with his voice. Great things doeth he which we cannot comprehend. By the breath of God ice is given. All that they viewed in nature was the work of God. His works might be beyond their comprehension, but still they were God's works. By the help of science, we can fill in by way of explanation that chain of linked cause and effect which they could not. But the chain still reaches back to God as the first cause. And science has not been able to eliminate him as the one supreme reality and ultimate explanation of the universe. The men of faith who wrote the Bible take faith's leap from phenomena to God. Science tries laboriously to construct a bridge across the chasm. When her task is complete, she will find that the prophets of Israel were right in placing God at the very source of things, and hence the Bible avoids encroachment into the sphere of scientific explanations, at the same time supplies a religious interpretation of the universe. If we consider that the theory of evolution disproves the account of creation, we must remember that it is not a question of facts, but of rival explanations. We do well when science dabbles in origins to remember the words of Professor Tyndall. Science knows nothing of the origin or destiny of nature. Who or what made the sun and gave his rays their alleged power? Who or what made and bestowed upon the ultimate particles of matter their wondrous power of varied interaction? Science does not know. The mystery, though pushed back, remains unaltered. Many of us feel that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in the present philosophy of science. The credulity, we cannot call it faith, with which many men cling to the theory of evolution is the result of their endeavour to leave God out of the question. They will have none of a supernatural explanation of the universe. It must be explained on a purely natural lines, that is, entirely apart from God. The theory of evolution, this is Professor Watson's address to the British Association in 1929, and he said, "The theory of evolution, a theory universally accepted not because it could be proved true, but because the only alternative special creation was clearly incredible." That's Professor Watson's address to the British Association in 1929. The issue again is quite clear. The theory of evolution is believed in by those whose prejudices prevent them from believing that God created the heavens and the earth. They have not been convinced by evidence that evolution has occurred. They feel they can believe no other, or else they would be driven to accept the Bible account of creation. The condition of affairs with regard to the theory of evolution was well described in the Times Literary Supplement in 1905, June the 9th, in reference to a number of professors who had written on the subject as follows. "Never was seen such a melee. The humour of it is that they all claim to represent science, yet it would puzzle them to point to a theological battlefield exhibiting more uncertainty, obscurity, dissension, assumption, and fallacy than their own. For the plain truth is that though some agree in this and that, there's not a single point in which they all agree. Battling for evolution, they have torn it to pieces. Nothing is left, nothing at all on their showing save a few fragments strewn about the arena. Well, let us hear no more about scientific contradiction of the Bible. Those familiar with other so-called religious books know the foolish and absurd explanations of natural phenomena which they contain. The Bible is unique in that it does not attempt them. It is remarkable for its omissions. When we contrast the dignified silence of the Bible with the puerile and mythical stories of the contemporary religions of Babylon, Assyria, and Egypt, we feel that in this we have another indication that God has inspired its authors and preserved them from the glaring errors which they would have incorporated if they had copied the mythologies of their heathen neighbours. Does the idea of the miraculous present an obstacle to your return to the Bible? The question-begging statement of Hume that miracles do not happen has become almost an axiom with some types of mind. Some think of a miracle as a violation or contradiction of the laws of nature, and this view is found in the words of Brother Tyndall: science does assert that without a disturbance of natural law of a very serious nature, no prayers avail to call showers from heaven or deflect towards us a single beam of the sun. But let Sir Oliver Lodge answer this. He says, the assertion is that any act, however simple, if achieved by the special volition of the Eternal, would be a miracle. And the implied dogma is that the special volition of the Eternal cannot, or at any rate does not, accomplish anything whatever in the physical world. This dogma is not really a deduction from any of the known principles of physical science. The alleged unscientific character of prayer for rain depends really not upon its conflict with any known physical law, since it need involve no greater interference with the order of nature than is implied in a request to a gardener to water the garden. It does not really depend upon the impossibility of causing rain to fall when otherwise it might not, but upon the disbelief of science in any power who can and will attend and act. If we believe in the existence of an omnipotent and omniscient God, then all things not involving a contradiction in terms or inconsistent with the idea of God are possible. Miracle is not in any way a contradiction of the laws of nature, for these are the laws of God, and it is contrary to the very idea of God to be self-contradictory. All creation is upheld in being by God, and nature but reveals the working of his wisdom. God works through the vast economy of nature, but as we learn from Revelation, he also works in special ways for the advancement of his purpose with his creature man, to whom he has given in the Bible a revelation of himself, which is miraculous because it is not produced by nature or by man. A miracle may then be regarded as a special working of God relative to his revelation and the development of his purpose. And such special workings can only be denied by those who deny the existence of God or conceive him to be a prisoner in the universe which he has created. A careful study of the Bible reveals that it is not uniformly saturated with miracles. These occur sporadically, in patches here and there, at special crises in the development of God's purpose. The exodus from Egypt, and the wilderness wanderings, the critical times of Elijah and Elisha, and the ministry of Christ and the apostles contain nearly all of the recorded miracles. The character of these miracles and the fact that they were signs ought to be carefully noted. It is customary to scoff at the miracle of Jonah and the whale. Yet consider the words, "The Lord prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah." Can we seriously argue that it was impossible for God to accomplish this? Science is unable to dogmatize and say that anything is a priori impossible which does not involve a contradiction in terms. The same word prepared is used in connection with the gourd that shaded Jonah, the worm that destroyed the gourd, and the vehement east wind that blew upon him. It denotes that it was appointed or ordained by God. The question of miracles is not really one of possibility, but of probability and testimony. The Lord Jesus Christ did not consider Jonah a character of fiction when he said, "The men of Nineveh shall stand up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, a greater than Jonah is here." And again he said, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale," by the way, the Greek is a sea monster, "so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." The exact species of fish is undetermined, for the Greek and the Hebrew terms are both quite indefinite. The essential point is that God had appointed the creature for the fulfillment of his own wise purpose. How much the miracle of Jonah's deliverance had to do with the subsequent conversion of the Ninevites, we cannot say. But undoubtedly it must have had a great effect upon their minds. The striking fact that meets us upon further study of Bible miracles is that the greatest economy is manifest in their use. They are never performed for evil ends or for personal advertisement, and they constantly exhibit a sign as well as a marvel.